Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 5 of That Gives Me Anxiety. What a difference a week makes. I was feeling awful last week after getting my second dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. Got the old Pfizer. It's just a lot easier to get things done when your head doesn't feel like it's pounding and you're just walking around dripping sweat for no reason. Actually, we've got a pretty good thunderstorm going on right now. I remember as a kid, I used to be very nervous about thunderstorms. And I remember other kids saying, with a lot of confidence, "Oh, there's nothing to be afraid of. It's just the gods bowling." The gods. As if we've gone back to ancient Greek and Roman gods. And why is that comforting? Kind of just makes you feel like the gods are like a bad roommate who makes too much noise in the common area, and we just have to deal with it. I will say, the bugs seem to be loving this thunderstorm, though. Just screaming. Another positive is that the birds in the backyard don't seem to be dive-bombing Ollie. So that's great to take one little anxiety off my plate. One anxiety as if it's like removing a chicken nugget off my plate. Well, let's talk about today's episode. Today is the season 1 finale of That Gives Me Anxiety. And in it, we're going to be talking about anxiety related to being a parent, becoming a parent, or just anxiety in general, while also having to be a parent. And my friend Tom Costello, who came on and was incredibly open. Tom's a great guy, and his honesty is really incredible in this episode. I also have a psychologist who's also a Harvard professor, David Rosmarin, who specializes in helping people with their anxiety. And he had a lot of very helpful things to say. All right, the season finale of That Gives Me Anxiety. Here we go. Tom Costello, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Pat. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm super excited to have you on, and thank you for being open. I know it's definitely a little nerve-wracking to talk about your anxiety related to being a parent and becoming a parent, and I just appreciate your openness.
Yeah, of course. Happy to do it.
Well, Tom and I know each other through a roommate that I had in Washington, D.C. when I lived there for a couple of years in grad school, Mark Gull. Was it Gull, right?
It's Gull.
Yeah.
But I do question it every time I I say it, just in case.
And I feel like he's the person that would let you mispronounce it and then laugh behind your back, being like, "Get a load of this guy."
Nicest guy in the world. And then he'd be speaking Ukrainian and slandering you.
Right, exactly. Yeah, absolute sweetheart of a man, but yeah, uses Ukrainian to his benefit.
Yep.
Well, right. Let's talk about becoming a dad for the first time. You have a daughter, right?
What's her name? Do. Her name is Georgia. We call her Gigi often. And she is just turned 3 years old in September. Aww.
And you have another one along the way?
I do. My wife is due next month. I don't know when this will come out. So my wife is due November 20th, but it's coming. Right. It's coming soon.
So walk me through. I'm not a dad yet. I would like to be in the future. But what's it like being told you're going to be a father for the first time?
You know, to be honest, like, unlike the women involved, you have a lot of time to really process or refuse to process this news.
Right, because your body's not changing.
Yeah, exactly. your body's not changing. You do understand to some degree, like, your wife is going to be a different person. They're going to sleep at odd times, you know, whatever. It's honestly not that different from how my wife is anyway. So it's kind of something that I deferred a lot of that work mentally and just was like, okay, yeah, we're having a baby. We'll take care of the things that we need to take care of ahead of time. Like I mentioned to you kind of before we started talking, we waited to find out what we were having, which again, like, kind of helped in that there wasn't that much we could do ahead of time. We weren't going to design a whole nursery. We were going to just have limited things available when the baby was here. So, Yeah, when you first find out, there was excitement because we were trying. We did want to have a baby, but yeah, it just kind of started a clock that I didn't pay too much attention to until my wife started drastically changing, and
yeah,
it started to kind of more impact my day to day, I would say.
It's true, by like almost delaying the decision, or not the decision, the like announcement of like the gender or whatever. It's like, yeah, we're just kind of, it's just like an abstract thing until here she comes. Here's Gigi.
That's right. Right. And we, you know, there was, you're going to meetings and you're trying to, you have different classes you have to take to prep yourself and to make sure you are, you know, registered by the hospital, and your OB kind of takes you through stuff too. And, you know, you start to put together a game plan and understand kind of intellectually what's coming. But yeah, the real deal didn't really kick in until baby's about to come out.
Right. So I want to talk about your like anxiety levels before having a kid. Would you describe yourself as anxious?
I would say to a certain degree, not like, I don't know. I don't think it was like super impacting my life. It was more that I could use it in a positive way. You know, I would have anxiety about work necessarily, like things like that.
Yeah.
But that just made me work harder or make sure I was on top of whatever I had to be on top of to kind of alleviate some of that.
Just climbing the ladder, cash and checks.
Yeah. Trying your best to keep moving up. But and keep up the facade that you belong there, which is its own battle. But
of course, yeah, I'm creating two podcasts on spec. I know exactly
about. There you go. This is real, and I'm fine to do this. So I know a lot about these things. But I would say the anxiety leading up to it and beforehand was more. There was kind of this degree of this is going to change my life significantly. So I think I maybe had some more, not anxiety, but restlessness around things I wanted to get out and do before the baby was there. And I knew I'd be kind of locked down. So that included spending time with friends and stuff like that. That included taking some classes and things that I wanted to take before. You know, again, I was.
You were taking sketch and.
UCB, yeah. So right? I finished the UCB kind of sketch curriculum and all that stuff. Really, the year I did it all while my wife was pregnant, and so I think that was, in a lot of ways, an outlet of fear where I was like, oh, maybe I won't be able to do these types of things anymore if I have a kid, or it'll delay it, or it'll kill my dreams, however remote. So yeah, I think it wasn't something that I was super like aware of all the time, but it was definitely present there, lurking in the shadows.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that. Like, I feel like, you know, all of our mutual friends that know you always described you as incredibly confident and relaxed. And I feel like an example of that was you joined the Rossi Paint Gullet Monsters, the name of our softball team at the time, for one night. I mean, you ended up joining the team more full time after. You had this amazing game. You were hitting home runs left and right, and then everyone was talking about going to get a beer, and you're just like, "No, I can't. I'm gonna go propose to my girl." Like, just like, what a night for you.
It does make me sound pretty cool in retrospect. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, it's funny because it really, I feel like that was also sort of born out of two things. One was anxiety. Actually, they're both kind of anxiety, because one was, you know, I'd been in the city for a little while at that point, and I just didn't know as many people. So it was harder to kind of connect into like a sports group or like a bunch of dudes who are like playing softball. So when I finally got the call, I was like, this is what I've been waiting for.
Yeah.
And then the second was that the game, I think, was at 5. My wife, my whole plan was to propose after she got out of work and kind of got herself together, because it was under the kind of guise of us going to dinner and she was going to meet me at my apartment. But I knew that that was going to be like 7:30, 8 o'clock at the earliest. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, what am I going to do? Just sit in this apartment, like stressing out nonstop.
Pacing back and forth. Right. Yeah.
And so, great. What a great outlet. Let me just go put my mind into something else for a little while and kind of not worry about it. So yeah.
Performance enhancing anxiety, just crushing home runs.
Exactly. I'm like, I'm not afraid of this pitcher. I'm afraid of, you know, committing to something for the rest of my life, but this next pitch is no problem.
Right. I've got
we
that.
We can put that bad boy wherever we want it.
Yeah. So moving on to when Georgia comes along, in discussing whether or not you wanted to be a part of this podcast, you mentioned that once she had come along, you had anxiety that you were nervous about letting her down, letting your wife down. Can you describe those feelings a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it's weird, like, kind of transitioning from you're this, even though I was married, like, you're still a very independent solo person. You really kind of, and the other individual that you're spending your time with, it's very easy to get feedback and see how you're doing. And as someone who's interested in things like performing and comedy and sports and things like that, like, I definitely crave like instant feedback and am I doing things right? And are you happy with me and stuff like that? Mm-hmm. And you don't get that from a baby. Like a baby's pretty much, you know, you do to a certain degree and that you could feed them and they could stop crying, but it's not a lot going on in terms of like, yeah, this is fun. I'm having fun, Dad. Yeah. I'm either, you'll know when they're uncomfortable, but when they're kind of neutral, you're like, are you right. good? Is everything working? I don't know. So
yeah,
there's some degree of that. Are the things I'm doing good? Am I knowledgeable enough to not make mistakes and make sure I'm being supportive partner? And
yeah. Right. So, there's a lot of things on top of that, right? I feel like your relationship changes with your wife as well. And
yeah,
wanting to make sure that's it. You know, it's so funny to hear that you're like, I'm used to like instant feedback, because I feel like in every friend group you've ever had, you've been like the funny guy. So it's like, you know right. how you're doing on any night because like absolutely. The laughs are coming or they're not.
Yeah, exactly. You know exactly how to feel about yourself based on.
Yes. Your self-worth is completely tied to the laughs.
Yep. That's definitely something we're working on, Pat, in our conversations with my therapist. But yeah, it is certainly a shock to the system because you're not going out. So you're not having that friend group time where, mm-hmm. where you're getting your instant feedback or goofing around or whatever. You're really just, you're tired, your wife's tired. And I would say the first couple years of being a father, I mean, I was probably close to depressed, if not like somewhat depressed for a lot of the time. And I think it comes from a death almost of your old self. As I got older, I mean, I'm not young, I'm 37. So I had Georgia, I guess, I don't know, I'm not going to do the math right now, but 3 years, I was 34 then, I guess. It was probably time to stop like leading a life of like nightlife and going out to bars and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But kind of saying goodbye to all of that at the same time, you can't really wean yourself off because you're just like, now I'm a dad. I have to go do all this dad stuff.
I went to the hospital and a baby was in the car on my way home.
And I, you know, you still get out a little bit, but like it definitely is different rules and different expectations. And it's hard going from being very independent to extremely dependent upon, you know.
Well, I second that mourning of your old self. I've definitely verbalized that to my girlfriend, Jamie, as friends are having babies and things are changing, and that's good. Like that should be happening, right? We shouldn't mm-hmm. be acting as we were when we were 22, but man, those times were great. So, and I loved who I was and I loved having fun and goofing around. And so I've gone through a period as other people have made that this decision.
Well, that's the thing too. It's like, that would help me at times was to look at my friends and just say, how much am I really missing out on? Or I'd get time to myself where my wife would be doing something else with the baby or staying at my in-laws or something, and I'd have a little bit of freedom. And I'm like, what do you guys want to do? Let's all hang out. And they are unable to do that because they're also becoming mature adults. And so like,
Like the time really has to align where everybody can.
It's not this big thing that I'm missing out on. And so it just, it took time with that. And just like, I think the intensity of our lives in the city, especially, like, you're always going, there's always something exciting to do. There's just from nonstop intake and madness all the time. Like, you're saying, I was saying no to more things a night than I even get invited to for a week now, you know? It's
and that causes anxiety crazy. In and of itself, because you feel like you're letting people down. I mean, that hurts me to my core, which is another thing I need to work on.
Yeah, you learn that nobody needs you, and they're not missing you that much, but that's okay. They just, you know, things are evolving. But,
right.
Yeah.
You mentioned a little bit, or in passings almost, about being in therapy now. That's great. What led to that decision, and what advice would you give to a parent or really anyone with anxiety about, like, actually taking the step to communicate with a therapist?
It's hard to like be aware sometimes of your mental state. I liked what you spoke about with the doctor about doing checkups a couple times a year just to kind of see where you're at. I think for me, I just, you know, I have a new baby. I went through a period where I had been laid off at a job that was basically this large kind of merger going on. And it wasn't like so much a personal thing, but it felt very personal, you know, even though you watched, you know, 100 coworkers go through it before you and 100 after, it still felt like, man, I can't believe this is happening. And so it was definitely a combination of a lot of things at once. And I just felt like I wasn't myself. I wasn't like this optimistic, like happy guy that was, or I was putting it on more to kind of just maintain. And so.
What, just like putting on like a happy face, you mean?
Yeah.
So like, this is what people expect of me.
And I never had to do that in the past. I was always just go, 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 feeling so good about just connecting with people and having fun and doing it. You know, all of that was just very much in my wheelhouse. And the thing is too, just dealing with how your wife has to change too, because she has to become this rock and this mother. And she's just not even interested in going to do those things anymore. So even if we were, you know, at least in the short term, when you have a very small baby. So it just was overwhelming. And I finally had enough insight and into myself to say, this isn't right. Like, the way I'm feeling isn't right. I should at least go see what this is all about and talk to somebody. So it was shortly after the layoff, and then having a like 3-month old at the time. And I went and did it, and it was interesting because I did it for a little while, and I was like, I don't know how it helped. It did help to just, part of it too is like, you have things that you worry about that maybe only worry about like 1%. Maybe it has something to do with your spouse or your girlfriend. You have this thought that, oh, I don't know. It's not, I don't even know how to phrase it, but it's like, you don't feel that way all the time. You only felt it for like 5% of a day, and maybe not even direct, not even to them, but maybe just like, oh, I don't know if I'm a good dad. I don't know if I want to be a dad. Just one day for an hour, you're like, I don't know if I wanted to be a dad, and this was a mistake. Now, that's not something you want to bring up necessarily to your significant other, start to put unnecessary fears into their mind, because that's not even how you feel 99% of the time.
Of course. But that 5% of time can be.
It's still, intense. It weighs on you.
Yeah.
And it's very nice to have someone to talk to and just say, hey, I had this thought. And sometimes I think of this, and sometimes I feel like this. And those aren't things that I want my wife to have to worry about, because most of the time I don't feel like that. But it is nice to just say, is this normal? Am I normal? What are tools I can use to cope to feel like a regular person, you know?
Yeah,
absolutely. And so I had done therapy, and it was only for a couple months, and then I had stopped for a while, then went back. And I think part of it too, and I think I would love to share that I don't think you're going to get it right the first time necessarily. Like, there is such a thing as a compatibility with a therapist, finding what you actually need in a therapist. And the first couple just, I don't know, I didn't like the way it was going necessarily. I didn't think it was helping me that much. But the one I have now is great. I feel like I can be my true, honest self. I feel like I don't necessarily know where he's going to go with interpreting what I'm saying and kind of giving me feedback or mm-hmm. or ideas. So I like that. I personally like that. So that's been helpful. Where in the other ones, I just felt like I could see where they would get to based on how I framed whatever I was about to say.
Okay.
And I'm like, that's so much pressure on me to frame it in the right way to you, solution that I think is going to help me.
Right.
I don't know.
It you just, don't want to be the,
it wasn't
the,
as good, the, but yeah, I would highly recommend it.
Yeah. You don't want to be both the like therapist and the person in therapy.
I felt like I was, and you know, maybe that's not true, but I don't know. I just didn't feel like I was hearing anything that was like making me kind of change too much. Yeah. But it's nice to get things out. So there was certainly a positive benefit to that.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I think it's great. I don't know, hearing somebody describing a moment in pain and what you did to resolve it. And, you know, a big part of this podcast is to help people coping with anxiety and depression and fear and all of that. So I think it's a good time for me to cut to, you mentioned I interviewed David H. Rosmarin, who's a assistant professor from Harvard. And we spoke about anxiety for people who are parents. So let's go to the clip. Joining me now on the podcast is David H. Rosmarin. He's an assistant professor at Harvard Medical School and founder of the Center for Anxiety in New York. His clinical work and research has been featured in Scientific American, the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. David, thank you so much for joining me. What an impressive resume you have.
That's kind of you to say. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, super excited to talk to you today because we're going to be talking about anxiety related to being a parent, becoming a parent, or just kind of living with anxiety unrelated to being a parent, but also being a parent.
Awesome. As a parent myself, I'm glad to be here.
Good. How many kids do you have?
Believe it or not, 6 kids at home.
6 kids. Oh my gosh. That's a lot of kids.
Enough to make you anxious?
Yes. I think I did. I think my palms got a little sweaty there. What's their age range?
The first two are the hardest. It gets easier after, you know, 3, 4 and 5 and 6, you know. I think at a certain, and by the way, it's for an important reason. At a certain point, you just realize I can only control so much. And once you come to that realization, I think a lot of the anxiety dissipates.
And I think that's like what a lot of like older kids complain about, where, you know, totally. It's like, I had it so much harder. I had so much, I'm a first child myself. And
me
like the
too.
Difference between me, see, the younger ones just have it. It's like a different parent at that
like,
point.
Like, mom, dad, when I was his age, there's no way you would have let me
punish
stay
her.
Out.
Come on.
Yeah. Like, come on, you're letting her get away with that?
Yeah. Please. Well, let's talk about becoming a parent. I feel like that's such a moment, and you hear it from, I'm not personally a father yet, I'd like to be in the future, but a lot of people describe that as almost like an inciting incident, right? Where it's like, oh my gosh, all of a sudden, I am a parent. Can that trigger anxiety that may be dormant, or someone comes to you with that? How do you approach that? How do you break that down?
Yeah, I was going to say it better trigger anxiety. I mean, I think that, you know, firstly, the whole process of, you know, birth is harrowing. And you know, I say that as a male who has not given birth myself. So all the more so for those who have gone through the process. And I think just realizing the number of things that could go wrong mm-hmm. in that process, and that's before even first breath, right? And then the real challenges start, like making, you know, basic decisions and how much do you respond to cries, to not, you know, mm-hmm. how do you, dealing with just the amount of stress and the co-parenting, hopefully, and trying to figure out what's your relative role. All of these are, it's a formidable life change. And I think anyone going through it would experience, I would imagine, I would expect, is a better word, a high degree of stress, and not to mention the financial concerns with it, and then healthcare and access to these things. So I think it's perfectly normal for people going through a life change event given the magnitude of becoming a parent, that they're going to feel stressed, they're going to feel tired, they're going to feel anxious at times. And the question isn't, I think, whether we're feeling that and whether, you know, that's sort of normal or not. I think it's, what do we do about that? And how do we handle those emotions?
Yeah, that is very important.
That's the biggest question.
Right. So how do we handle those emotions, right? Like, I think that leads right into the next question.
Yeah, I think that's the main question. Number one is not to judge yourself. I'll tell you what not to do, right? Not that self-judgment is so toxic for anxiety and for really for anything. We had this myth in American culture, in Western culture, that we're always supposed to feel perfect. And we're always supposed to feel happy. And it's just not true. I mean, yesterday I was just feeling sluggish, right? I don't know why. I just felt sluggish. And I'm like, okay, you know, it's not going to be as productive as a day. You know, today's a little better. Why? I don't know why. I got better sleep two nights ago than I did last night.
Who knows?
Who knows? And that's fine. That's part of life. That's just what it is. And can we roll with it? So that's number one, I would say, is just roll with it. If you're having a hard time as a new parent, new mom, new dad, new whatever, and you're feeling at your wit's end, don't judge yourself. Just roll with it. Let yourself struggle. Let yourself be imperfect, feel imperfect. That doesn't mean that you are imperfect.
Well, you're right. This myth of always feeling like we should be happy. And on top of that, I feel like for parents, there's the myth, especially with like Instagram and social media, that there are perfect parents who always make the right choice and their kids are fulfilled. And you know, it's just paper thin, but people don't realize that.
It's not even paper thin. It's pixels. It's nothing. There's literally no substance to it.
Yeah, I completely agree. So that's great to hear, to just not judge yourself. You know, we're so hard on ourselves for so many things. And
I would fully agree with that.
That's good. Good. Glad to hear that. So step one is not judging yourself. Step two, a lot of the people I've spoken to for this podcast talk about kind of breaking down what's making you anxious and sort of looking at the pieces, sort of deconstructing that. Is that an approach that you would subscribe to?
100%. I would take something in the context of becoming a parent, though, for the first time. I think there's another aspect of it. And this applies to people who are in partnered relationships when they become a parent for the first time. If the person's not, then even then they should reach out, but obviously not to their partner if they don't have one. It's critically important, I believe, for managing our anxiety to be able to not only accept our vulnerability and our lack of equanimity all the time and our lack of perfection, but to allow ourselves to express that to a loved one and to be able to say to one's partner, I'm really overwhelmed. I'm really having a hard time. I'm not perfect. I'm at my wit's end. I'm really struggling. Today I started to feel panic. Today I started to cry out of the blue. I think that's critically important to be able to say to the other and then to receive comfort from them. Sometimes we don't want to reach out to, you know, a loved one and say, hey, I'm really having a hard time. Can I have a hug? And I think that's part of being a human, especially becoming a parent for the first time, and or even just being a parent in general. If there is a partner involved, to reach out. And if there isn't a partner involved, then to find someone to reach out to who you can speak to and tell the truth.
Yeah. You know, a part of why I started this podcast is I certainly have a bit of anxiety myself, and you know, it can feel very debilitating at times. And I've gotten a lot of good advice by talking to people such as yourself, and just the power of, to back up what you're saying, acknowledging how I feel and saying it to my girlfriend, Jamie, 10 times out of 10, she'll respond with something that's comforting, or it just sort of eliminates that. And especially as a man, I feel like at times men keep that bottled inside and
totally
don't allow it out. And so I really want to encourage men and women, of course, not to gender.
Yeah, anxiety. I think there are some gender differences, and you did pick up on something. But of course, you can't predict it with 100% accuracy.
Exactly.
Some females are much more tight-lipped, and some men are much more expressive. So
exactly. Yeah.
It is independent of gender, though. I think there are some generalities there for whatever historical and other reasons.
Of course. Bottom line being exactly what you're saying. Opening up is
open up. Don't pretend to be perfect to the people who you love. That usually will draw people closer. You know, you said something really interesting, which is that Jamie, 10 out of 10 times, will respond well to you. Mm-hmm. When a loved one expresses vulnerability to their partner, that partner, if they're upset about something, usually their defenses go away because you just showed that you need them. So they're more able to comfort and to step in and to, so it often reinforces the relationship.
Mm.
And those love relationships, those connections can be enhanced through the process of showing vulnerability and need.
And it feels good.
Feels great.
Yeah.
Feels great. There's science behind that too, by the way.
That's good to know. When does, let's say someone's anxious about being a parent, when would you recommend they come to someone such as yourself? When is it?
Yes, I was going to say. So the step one, as we put it before, is accept yourself, accept your limitations, accept your anxiety. Step two, reach out to a loved one. Talk to them about how you feel. Show them your vulnerabilities. Sort of being vulnerable by yourself, being vulnerable with others, if you will. Then I think what you said before about unpacking it and trying to talk it through. Just the acceptance will take down a lot of the edge. Mm-hmm. But unpacking, what am I concerned about? Sometimes people are racing so quickly, you know, especially being a parent, being a mom, being a dad, there's just so much you're doing. So mm-hmm. in that harried state of, you know, parenthood, can we take the time and actually unpack it and think through what we're thinking? Are we aware of it? Can we take inventory of our thoughts and either with the help of a friend or by ourselves say, hold on, I'm catastrophizing. Hold on, I'm mind reading. I don't really know that information. I'm thinking about what someone else is doing or saying. I don't really know that. And can we keep our mind in check? And I would say that would be sort of a step three. Or can we take our mental inventory and keep our heads more level?
And breaking that down further, you're describing, right, we're in this state of worrying about what someone else is thinking or all these things are happening. How do you actually go about breaking things down?
Yeah. So one step we use in cognitive therapy is called the downward arrow technique.
Okay.
Downward arrow. The downward arrow is basically, the question is, if so, then what? So let's say I'm worried about, I don't know, something with one of my kids. Mm-hmm. So if so, if that really happened, then what? What would happen? And I'm like, oh, well, then it would be, I don't know, this. Oh, that would be really bad. Okay. So, but if that happened, then what? And just to keep that process going, it's usually uncomfortable because as you're thinking about what you're concerned about, you're not avoiding the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually focusing on them and allowing yourself to feel it and to think it. But that's an important process, just to be able to process how we're going. So
and then you follow it questions. Down to like a conclusion. So let's
following
say
it down to as far as you can go, really.
Okay. So for practice sake, sure. I'm a parent. I'm nervous that at soccer practice, my child is going to break a leg. So then,
okay.
If then what would be, oh my gosh, they'd be in so much pain.
They'd be in pain.
How do I get them to the hospital? How do I pay for that? Right. The next step and on and on and on. And then like, okay. Eventually I might get to, well, and in the
well,
end.
I would actually pause it. I would say, let's say they're in pain. So if so, then what? So then they're going to be in pain. It's not pleasant to have your kid in pain.
Right.
But then what would be the consequence of that?
They'd be crying.
Okay. And is it that you can't handle the cries or that you
want to take away their pain?
Okay. Yeah. It's very upsetting to have them pain, have them go through pain. What about that though is so upsetting?
That I want them to know that they're safe and
good. So the concern really is that they're going to feel that the world is unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
What about that do you need?
Well, I guess they do need to know.
They do to some degree, but they also need to know that there are some dangers. So
exactly.
Let's say they felt that the whole world was unsafe. Then they're going to never play soccer again, never go outside again.
Those are unlikely.
So at a certain point, it becomes like, what am I really letting it go too far here? Or is this you know, but if you're not aware of those thoughts, then you can't really process it. Plus just allowing yourself to experience it, I think habituates ourselves to it. Then you mentioned the money. So let's say a person feels I can't pay for it.
Yeah.
What would they do?
Borrow money from a family member or put
could
it
be
on a credit
and
card.
Then would that be uncomfortable, would that be upsetting? Yeah. Would they have an idea? Okay, and then what about that, what would that bring up?
You know, embarrassment, shame,
sure,
that you couldn't afford that, and
sure, yeah. Is that something you could not live with?
You'd have to, right? I feel like at that point you'd be like, this is what I have to do,
so we have so to we'll do it. So again, coming, getting sort of thinking it through can help you get to a place of more acceptance, more understanding of it, and also just allowing yourself to experience it. These are cognitive therapy techniques.
Yeah. You know, that's funny. This is a completely hypothetical situation, and I felt better about it.
How about that?
I could physically feel that even in a hypothetical situation. So that's great. But you were about to say something?
Well, I was going to tell you what step four is, though. Step four, which is probably maybe my favorite, although step two is pretty good, too, the connecting to others. Self-acceptance, acceptance with others, keeping your thoughts in check, and finally, I would say, is our behaviors. Facing your fears, standing up to that demon of fear, and persevering, pushing through it, allowing yourself to experience that emotion, that is hugely effective in managing anxiety. We call this exposure therapy, where people expose themselves. I'm sure you've had other folks on the...
Yes, particularly in the discussion about flying and that.
Yes, definitely.
It gets a little bit easier as you've sort of done it.
It gets easier, not even sort of. The only way to overcome your fears is to get up on a plane. And sometimes you need a therapist with you, and that's totally fine. We've done that a lot. You know, we've flown private, had, you know, or commercial with patients. And people have all sorts of ways to avoid their anxiety. Like they'll sit in the plane, but they'll sit in the aisle seat, or they'll sit in the window. But so they're doing it in order to minimize their anxiety. So whatever makes you feel more anxious, we would want you to do it. If you feel more anxious in the middle seat, you're in the middle. Middle of the back of the plane, that's where you're going.
You know, it's funny. I have another question, but it just like reminds me of like your uncle who throws you in the pool when you're nervous about swimming.
Right. So let me talk to you about that uncle. We do not do that as therapists.
Okay.
Okay. So everything with the patient is at their consent. They have to voluntarily do it. It could actually backfire if a patient isn't voluntarily engaging in the process. Mm-hmm. We just encourage them very strongly to do so.
Sure. So let's put this in, you know, we were using flying as an example, but,
oh, okay.
But yeah, but talking about, you know, facing your fears as
mom and dad. Yeah.
What's a, for instance, that we could.
Perfect. Let's go back to your example of the kid who we're concerned is going to have break their leg. Was it? And yes. Then they're going to be in lots of pain and they're going to be screaming. And then they're going to be in, you're going to have to pay for the treatment and you're not going to, you might have to borrow money from a, you know, a family member. Is going to be embarrassing for you. And the kid's going to feel afraid and they're not going to be able to go out. So what we did just now is a little bit of exposure therapy, but I would want to that because we're worrying, we're actually increasing our worry. What I would recommend to parents in that kind of situation, if they're feeling overwhelmed by their anxiety, to write out what they're afraid of and to spend 5 minutes a day really, really sweating it out and worrying to the nth degree, pushing their mind like, oh, wow, it would be really bad. How could I possibly handle that if that were to happen? I wouldn't be able to forgive myself. And letting yourself go there just for 5 minutes a day and to schedule it. Be like, on my lunch break, 12:05 p.m., in my calendar, 5 minute worry time.
What is the, it's so interesting because it makes me think of, you know, our bodies adapt.
Correct.
You know, our taste buds adapt to bitter if we start drinking IPAs or coffee or spicy foods. Is it just our bodies adapting towards?
There is a habituation process, but there's something else going on, which is that when we learn, by the way, it's a great question what you asked, and the research has borne this out. It used to be thought that it was all about habituation. Like you said, I get used to drinking bitter. I get used to the cold, right? I'm from Toronto originally, you know. Now that I live in the United States and, you know, I'm much less used to the cold, right? Because have less of it, less of that bitter cold anyway, even though I'm in the Northeast. But it's not only about habituation. There's something else going on, which is that by approaching your anxiety as opposed to running away from it, we actually learn that we have a much greater degree of agency over it. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that only happens to you. It's something that we actually have some sort of, I wouldn't say control, but we have some influence over. I can make my anxiety much higher right now, and I can actually make it less. And once we learn that we can modulate our emotional experience, the whole thing becomes a lot less mysterious. It's not out of the blue happening to me. I'm not a passive participant in the anxiety game. I'm actually an active role. I can make it worse and I can make it better.
That's terrific news, right? Like for a lot of people, I feel like anxiety is, you know, the monster under the bed.
Correct.
And then in this instance, you know, you're driving the car and the anxiety is just a passenger.
Correct. And you can actually increase it and there's nothing negative that it's going to happen to necessarily.
Yeah. That's really good news.
When we have patients who have panic attacks, we will, in our clinic, and many other people do this as well, it's not only us, exposure therapy has them specifically panic. We want them to panic. We have them, you know, breathe through a very thin straw in order to make their, you know, one of those coffee straws.
Yeah.
Make them have the sensations of discomfort. Or we have them sit in a really hot room and feel flushed.
Really?
Or we have them spin around in a chair, right? So they feel dizzy. Or run upstairs.
And then you're just there to see.
We coach them. We're there to coach them, to encourage them to face their fear. And the net result of it is, oh my God, that was so bad. And I let it go. I'm able to face it. I'm able to be vulnerable with someone else there. I'm able to go home and talk to my loved one about it. It sort of brings everything together.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Just wanted to poke my head in here, Will, real quick, to let you know that today's episode is brought to you by My Software Tutor. Are your Excel skills optimized for your current job? I remember the stress I felt having to switch from Final Cut Pro to Premiere. They're both video editing software. It can be daunting to switch or have to continuously learn a new program. In fact, I learned Premiere by telling a company that I knew Premiere when I didn't. And I just figured it out and really threw myself into the pool to make sure I knew it because I knew I needed to know it. So learning software is very important, especially if you lied and need to catch up. Do you know the basics but need to learn more? My Software Tutor offers 3 levels of real-time Zoom-based courses with a live instructor. Yeah, I need a live instructor. There's a lot of video tutorials out there, but having someone ask questions feels a lot better, a lot easier. They all deliver practical, functional business skills in a friendly, supportive environment. These courses will increase your marketability, whether you're an employee, job seeker, consultant, or contractor. Register at mysoftwaretutor.com and use the promo code POD20 to save 20% off all registrations. Today's episode is also brought to you by The Cardist. This is a service that basically helps you mail cards with a special message on the inside. They help you write that. That's amazing. Because Jamie's always laughing at me because I usually just write the person's name, dear so-and-so, and at the end just write love, Pat and Jamie. Just when you get to writing the card, you feel so put on the spot. I'm pretty expressive with how I feel in my relationship with my friends or with my family. So yeah, it's also hilarious to be admitting that I feel like I'm really put on the spot and couldn't think of anything to say. 8 years of improv training down the drain. But with so many birthdays, there's no time to shop for cards, write the cards, and buy the stamps. Now you can do it all right where you sit, because the Cardist Studio does it for you. That's great. I want more things where people do it for you. Make your life easier. Introducing a writing specialist for the message inside your greeting cards. The Cardist Studio creates your message, writes it in the card, and mails it for you. The post office... One tough thing when I used to live in Brooklyn was the lines at the post office. Insane. South Carolina, it's just, you walk right in, you walk right out. The most recent man who helped me was like smiling at me. I'm so used to the post office just being like, get out of here. We have more people to get in. Just see the line, hurry up. All you do is pick the card and tell why you're sending it. No more errands, no more anxiety. For a message from your heart, but not your hands. Sit back and just enjoy your relationships. thecardistudio.com. Thoughtful just got easy. And you can use the promo code ANXIETYPOD for 10% off all orders.
I want to just recap the four steps. Can you tell me what they are and briefly?
You got it. Number one is accept your own anxiety. Don't judge yourself for it. Let yourself have a bad day or bad days or bad weeks or however long it is. Don't have that unreasonable expectations of your emotional experience. Mm-hmm. Number two is to share that with somebody else. Hey, I'm struggling. Hey, I'm having a hard time. Ideally a loved one, you know, a friend, can be a professional also, but just having that experience of going to somebody else and saying, hey, I'm having a hard time. Number three was keeping your thoughts in check, being aware of your thoughts, using the downward arrow technique. If so, then what? Thinking through, what am I upset about? And am I being reasonable? And is there another way to think about this? I mentioned panic attacks before. So people often say, if I have a panic attack, I'll die. Well, how many times has that happened? You know, if I have a panic attack, I'll faint. How many times has that happened? Most people say, well, never. How convinced are you? Very. Well, why? Like, what's that about? And finally, then the fourth step, where we actually face our fears head on, moving forward, letting it wash over you, and learning that we have greater agency and mastery over our anxiety than we might think.
Yeah. You know, there's so much about anxiety that feels like we're using our imaginations to the degree. And so, yeah, this is all such good advice to shift your mind from that runaway train of imagination to a more grounded, you know, you're in a lot more control than you think. Is there anything else that I'm missing?
I will say this. The scariest thing about being a parent is something that people usually don't think about, which is the effects of our emotions and our ability to navigate those emotions on the child. Typically, I'll tell you this, from seeing parents and children, teen adults and kids in our practice at the Center for Anxiety, I've never met an anxious kid who did not have at least one anxious parent.
We learn so much from our parents. That makes perfect sense.
We do. They model for us. They show us the ropes. We learn from them. Even if they don't say anything to us explicitly, we can see it. So I have seen parents come in and say, hey, I've started to see my kid getting anxious. I need help myself. Those are the best cases.
Oh,
you get two, great. You get a two for one, because you do. I've seen it happen many times where we help the parents to overcome their anxiety and the kid needs very little support, if any, afterwards.
That's amazing. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it makes it sound as though, you know, one of the best things you can do for your child is
no question
handling your anxiety.
There's no question. I think learning how to, especially in this era of increased, not only prevalence of anxiety, but increased severity of anxiety. You know, younger adults and young kids, teens and younger adults have far greater anxiety than they ever have and greater than older generations. So parents can do a wonderful, wonderful benefit to the next generation by learning to manage and handle their own anxiety. And there are really good tried and tested methods. This is not rocket science. It seems so amorphous and difficult and chronic. And in many cases, the majority of cases, at our clinic, 90% of our cases, of our patients, have significant reductions in symptoms over the course of treatment.
Oh, wow.
And we're not practicing anything that other people aren't doing. I mean, these practices they're widely available.
Right.
I don't see why people wouldn't get help if they're not struggling. Unless they don't have access to care or can't afford it. I mean, that I understand. But if people are in an urban area where you have an anxiety clinic and they have the means to be able to access treatment, it's a no-brainer.
On top of like dealing with your anxiety, you're also handing down feeling okay with your emotions. It's not only just like handling your anxiety, you're also teaching emotional intelligence, which
that is
so
true.
Valuable.
That's very true.
Why do you think, and maybe this is something that people discuss, why aren't people seeking treatment for their anxiety?
I think there's a couple of things going on. Number one, there still is some stigma about, you know, mental disorders. I think it's been a lot less, especially since coronavirus came to town. Mm-hmm. People are much more open about these things than they were even a few months ago. I think that's a welcome trend. And I'd like to see that continue in many ways. But at the same time, there is still some stigma, some shame that people have. That culture of, I should be better, I should feel okay, why do I feel this way? That self-blame and that judgment. I think that is a barrier to people acknowledging that they need help, going and seeking and getting the help that they need. I think it's probably the primary barrier.
Yeah, most likely. Oh man, it's so heartbreaking to think though that people, as you're describing, 90% of people would walk out after treatment, you know, with a significant reduction in their anxiety.
I'll give you another stat if you want from my clinic.
Love 80%,
stats. 80% of those patients are beneath the clinical level of severity after just 7 sessions.
Really? Oh my gosh.
Many of them continue afterwards, but if they cashed in, so to speak, after 7 sessions, everyone's...
That's incredible. And it's like, if you were cold, you'd put a sweatshirt on. If you're anxious, why wouldn't you
remove that
weight? Yeah.
Let me ask you, do you have a dentist?
I do.
Do you go to the dentist?
Twice a year.
Twice a year. That's the American Dental Association has those guidelines.
Exactly.
I can't for the life of me figure out why the American Psychological Association hasn't recommended that people go to a practitioner twice a year for a checkup.
Yeah.
You're going to take more care of your teeth than your mind and your emotions? That doesn't make sense to me.
That's a good point. Yeah. Usually it's just a cleaning, right? It's nothing. Whereas there's a lot more going on in my mind and everyone else's mind. So I'd like to see that as well. I think I know I would benefit from that. Pretty much everybody would. So,
sure.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me on the show. Nice chat.
So what'd you think?
I mean, smart guy. No, very useful stuff and helpful to hear, you know, just the fact that we need to normalize conversations around mental health.
Absolutely.
You know, there's so much pressure, especially on men, to just shoulder all the burden and not. But I find that shuts me down. It makes me someone I'm not. And I'd rather talk through these things and kind of get to a better place.
What do you mean? And what shuts you down?
Anxiety.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. As you're kind of trying to just burden, you know, carry all the burdens that you have on yourself without any help, it's tough.
Right. Especially with, you know, I love what he was saying about there are all these techniques that make anxiety sort of more a passive player, and realizing that a lot of times with your anxiety, you're inventing something, you're imagining something and running away with it, right? And you don't even realize that you're doing it and it can take over. Whereas working through some of your issues, you can learn to stuff that monster back under the bed, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. The ability to kind of figure out that you have some level of control over the anxiety. And it just comes back to self-awareness and being like, okay, I'm spiraling, I'm on edge. Mm-hmm. I try to do that, I guess, when I find that I'm not behaving like myself, if I'm becoming more tense or I'm, you know, getting frustrated with what's going on. And it happens a lot as a parent, because you don't have control. Like you only have, you know, he said it.
He's going to do what she needs to do. Yeah.
He said it. Like after 2 kids, he realized how little he actually was able to control. Right. You know, I don't want to find out that way by having 6 kids, but it's true. It's very true. And as someone who's kind of, I felt like, again, being an independent person, I had a lot of control over my life. And one thing that has come up with me a lot with therapists has been, I had a coping mechanism of, if I had something that was making me anxious or a lot of work to do or something, my method a lot of times was front loading it. Like I would do a lot of work up front. Mm-hmm. College, for example, like you get a syllabus, you know exactly what's going to be due, when it's going to be due, all the things you have ahead of you. Mm-hmm. And that's an environment I thrive in, because I'm very good at, I'm going to do everything necessary to then allow myself to go have fun and be carefree and not have to worry about anything. But a kid is a new Rubik's Cube every single day, and you can't front load parenting.
Oh, I see. Exactly.
You have to do it in the moment. You have to be in the moment.
Like you're building up the steam valve
and then letting it go and then building it up and letting it go.
Yeah.
Yeah. A kid is always there.
Yep. And so you have to understand that sometimes you are not at your best as a parent. Take a step back, let your spouse or a significant other kind of lean on them, co-parent. And I think my wife and I, especially in the last year, have been very good at that. We could tell when we're getting short with each other or with our daughter, and we're just like, hey, look, I got this, because I have a lot of patience right now. I'm feeling good. I will handle. You go lay down, do what you need to do.
That's great.
Yeah, and that really saves us.
That was an interesting aspect of what he was saying about working out, and that can be a source of anxiety for couples who are having, you know, a child for the first time, or just having a child and, you know, living with the child. What was that process like for you? Was it, I mean, obviously it's an ongoing thing, but.
Yeah. My wife and I are both very, like, we'll take it all on ourselves all the time. So we're like, that's, I guess, our love language is doing the work and stuff like that. So, you know, we have to be aware of ourselves. And I think we're doing an okay job about that, but we're even better about being aware of each other. And that's what's come with the time, is being like, okay, I can tell that she's in a place where she needs to go sit down. Mm-hmm. Or she could say, hey, like, let me handle dinner or whatever it is. Because at least in my experience with parenthood, there is some degree of doing work up front to pay dividends later. Like, for example, eating. You have to try a lot of different foods. You have to push things multiple times with your child to, like, get them to just make healthy choices and being okay with the healthy choices that you're giving them. But that stuff does not happen first go. And so it takes a lot of patience and perseverance. Or, like, honestly, the kids will eat three things their whole life if you let them.
Yeah.
But I can see how that happens, because it's just so much easier. You've gone through an entire workday. You've done all this stuff, and all you want to do is just, can we just eat and be done with it? And so you just want to give them what you know they'll eat. But
yeah. Can we eat and then start the battle for bath time?
Yeah. Bath's been good lately, but yeah, oh, nice. there have been times where that was a fight. Still, nap time can be a little bit of a fight and bedtime, but it comes and goes in waves, and you just try to weather the storm together.
Yeah, that's great. It seems like therapy is teaching you a lot about sort of just riding the storm and not looking to prevent it, right? The storm's coming, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's nothing you can do. You can do maybe a few things ahead of time, but really you just got to be present. And that's, you know, I know things are obviously a little bit different being kind of quarantined with COVID and all that, but it's been really great in a lot of ways, just spending so much time with our daughter. We have her home because of the pregnancy. It's a little risky to send her to daycare or anything like that. So we don't want to do anything to add any additional risk, which, you know, how many times are you having kids in your life? Like, not that many times. Even if you're having six, you're only having them six.
Right. Yeah. Not having six.
And so for us, it's been really special to kind of grow our relationship with our daughter. Before this, it's like you have her full time on the weekend, you're spending time with her, but during the week, it's like you're taking her to daycare in the morning, you're picking her up, trying to feed her and put her to bed at night. So it's like 3 hours a day, 4 hours a day. You go from that to every waking moment, and there's a little bit of growing pains there, but I wouldn't trade it for anything. It's been incredible to spend that time with her. But we've all learned a lot about ourselves, you know, in the process.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's really wonderful to hear. Thank you for sharing all that.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to talk to you about was what he was describing with, we'll make you anxious in therapy by, like, having people breathe through a straw or spinning them in a chair. Have you done anything like that?
I haven't. It's interesting because I feel like that is something I forced upon myself a lot.
How so?
I did stand up. I was very afraid of being in front of people. And I kind of took a class where I knew I would have to do it, more acting class and things like that, because I knew that entertaining people and being funny, like, was something that I really enjoyed. I just had a barrier of I'm afraid to kind of get in front of people.
Totally. I totally agree with that sentiment. Yeah. Like, you know, did improv for many years here in New York and sketch, and a part of like why I wanted to do these podcasts was I felt so alive doing that. And so it scares me, but it genuinely, otherwise I feel like if I'm not scaring myself, I feel like I'm not fully living, which is a scary thing to say, but
it's true. That was a hard part to get over, because it's hard to put yourself in scary situations when you're a father. Not that any of these are physically scary, but it's just like you have less opportunity to kind of go test something out or whatever it may be. So, but yeah, that's always been a little bit of my mind state, and I'm fairly adventurous. I try not to let too many things hold me back, but usually I just face the fears head on.
So are you finding you're able to, you know, you described before having the kid and this death of self, are you finding you're able to find other things that interest you, or how are you evolving?
Yeah, it's what I learned is that it's just going to be tough for a few years. There's still outlets that you can find. I guess it's good to have larger goals so you can figure out small ways to work on those goals, even when you're a little more limited. But I would say as my child's gotten older, my anxiety about giving up my whole life or whatever it is like has changed considerably, because you know, she's three now. We can have conversations. She comes up with jokes on her own. Like, we have such an amazing dynamic now where she's always cracking me up. We're doing silly things together. And that's more of the parenthood that I always expected.
Yeah.
It was just hard to get through having a baby. Having a toddler is very challenging and requires a lot of your time, and you don't feel like you're making a lot of progress. But now she's just quicker with those type of things, and you're can getting see that instant real feedback. Results. Yeah, I know. It is true. But it's making me feel okay about this second baby now, where I'm just like, okay, I'm signing on for two more years of kind of black box, but it's all good, because I can see increasingly the output and what it's going to be, and just how incredible it is to have this little person who has these funny ideas. And now I'm in like the prime of what I wanted to be as a father, which is someone who's encouraging them to be creative, who's encouraging them to use their imagination and never shutting that down, and always kind of, I don't know, just fostering things that maybe I wish even my parents had known to kind of encourage, not that they didn't, but they just, that wasn't like something that they thought about.
Right.
And so, yeah, just pushing her abilities, even just being like, yeah, let's make up this story, or let's do this. And
yeah. And one day the two of you will sit down and watch Point Break
and absolutely
fully connect.
that's our version of a quinceañera.
Yeah, exactly.
You're ready for this.
You're ready.
Put on your board shorts. We're watching. Put on your FBI suit. We're watching Point Break. That'll be a special day for us in our household.
I would imagine so.
I'll bawl like a baby.
Right? Especially when she references it for the first time.
Yeah, exactly. Daddy, get me two.
Yeah. Like, that's my girl.
My girl. yeah, so it's been I think seeing a little bit more of the breathing room and the outcome, and then now I can project that out into, okay, if you're six, if you're eight, if you're 10, I could take you anywhere. We can do anything. We can go on adventures. We can travel. You know, if anything, we're being creative together. You're elevating me. And so
so nice.
Yeah, it took a while to kind of get to this point, but it's just an adjustment, man. And it's hard to like, how frequently are you going through that big of a life change? And like having like that job thing and other things is just like,
there's almost going like out of like room for anything else at that point, you know?
Crazy, crazy. But I wouldn't change anything. I feel like I'm a better man today than when I began this process. Just learn what's important. How to live a sustainable, like fun life that isn't based on whether or not you're going out and doing things like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, those things are great, but like, they also help you escape. They help you escape maybe dealing with unhappiness or unsatisfaction that you might have with yourself. So when you don't have anywhere to escape to, you got to kind of, like the doctor said, you're really there experiencing it and taking it head on.
And not being afraid of that.
Which leads to growth, right?
Yeah. And also think it's good to find joys in the smaller moments, right? Like joking with your daughter while washing dishes or, you know, bath time or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I feel like that can make things easier when things are harder.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's a big part of it. And like just being present. And when you're not going out, like drinking beers and doing stuff like that, it's easier to have kind of a more steady, just neurological experience. Like, mm-hmm. this is just like what my brain is, and I can find joy and I can see what makes me happy. And mm-hmm. it's less of a roller coaster like it is being a young adult in the city when you're just trying to find yourself. And,
right.
you know, yeah. but it does. Being present, being with that child and being present is just so special, and watching their little faces and how their minds work is a treat.
I love that. Well, Tom, thank you so much for being so open and sharing your insights, and I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. I recommend parenthood to any of those on the fence, because I think any of the difficulties that I had or the anxiety that I faced, these are things that I still probably would have had to deal with eventually. Mm-hmm. It just kind of, it certainly throws a little gasoline on that fire and makes you seek out the help a little bit sooner because everything's so intense. But I'm just happier with who I am, you know, finding who you are as a person. I think parenthood really helps drive that. I don't think you have to be a parent to get there, but it worked for me. It helped me. You know,
don't be afraid of therapy.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. Yeah. I agree. I'm not going to breathe through little straws anytime soon, but
you're not going to spin me in that chair. Well, yeah, let's talk.
I'm not sitting in the middle seat on that plane, Doc. I tell you what.
Right. There's a reason why I'm anxious about that. Yeah. It's discomfort.
Yeah, exactly. My anxiety is mainly based on whether or not someone is stealing my armrest. But.
Thanks again. I hope there was something in there that provides some comfort. You know, anxiety can be hard enough. I can only imagine adding being a parent on top of that. Just want to remind you to check the show out on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or YouTube. And if you're liking the show, to please remember to rate and review it. Also, check out my other podcast, Death Space Filling the Void, which episode 1 of season 2 is going to kick off next Thursday. This podcast will return after 10 episodes of Death Space with 10 episodes of its own, but I'm also gearing up to start recording season 3, so I'd love to hear from you if you have an episode suggestion that you want to be a part of or just an idea in general. Let me know. As always, thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk soon.